This episode is brought to you by Irish Spring Body Wash and Bar Soap. When it comes to your shower routine, Irish Spring knows that what matters most is feeling refreshed. It's crisp, fresh, unmistakable scent. Zings your brain, awakening your senses. So you emerge from the shower ready to take on the day and smell great while you're doing it. Irish Spring Body Wash and Bar Soap. Fresh, green, Irish. Shop now at Walmart.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE SIPC.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We've got another outstanding guest this week. He is a three-time champion of the United States, three-time champion of the Ukraine, and best known these days as a prolific and acclaimed author and chess teacher, GM Lev Albert. Thank you for joining us on Perpetual Chess.
My pleasure, Ben.
So I'm pretty excited to have you as a guest, Lev. And among the many topics we want to talk about, I feel like you're a perfect person to sort of set the scene for the upcoming World Championships, because you wrote this incredible book about the last World Championship, Carlsen versus Karjakin. And to be fair, you wrote it with your co-authors, John Krumiller and the esteemed Vladimir Kramnik. So how do you compare, how do you anticipate this World Championship versus the last one?
Well, they certainly would be different. The constant is Magnus Carlsen. His opponents would be very different people. Sergei Karjakin and Fabiano Caruana, they both are great players, but they're certainly very different players. About Karjakin, I spoke a lot and wrote a lot about it in this book. I certainly can discuss it with you right now, but mostly your listeners are familiar with Karjakin. He's he's great in defense. He's also great in critical situation. In other words, he performs the best when it demanded, in the decisive game, decisive events like World Championship match. That's why before the match I felt that his chances are practically as good as Carlsen's chances, even if Carlsen was higher by rating, almost close to, I guess, 60 or 80 points. Fabiano is different. Fabiano is more classic player. He's good at almost everything. He performs very well both in decisive events, but also in normal events. Again, Carlsen is somewhat higher by rating, but Caruana has shown one time after another that he can, when he's in good shape, he can beat anybody and he can win a big tournament ahead of anybody, including Carlsen. I think that if in case of Karjakin, I still was a little bit close, especially considering the blitz at the end, where Carlsen was stronger, a little bit stronger in both blitz and active chess. It wouldn't be so with Caruana. So with Karjakin, I saw chances are like 51 to 49 in favor of Carlsen. With Caruana, I would say it's 50-50, or maybe even very slight plus for Caruana, mostly because Caruana would be hungrier than Carlsen. Carlsen already was there, and he was he is world champion. He's been world champion for several years, so he's not that hungry, I would say. So this may give Caruana some small extra chance, extra plus. Otherwise, I think they are different, but they are quite evenly measured, and we can expect a very interesting fight. Probably even more spectacular than the fight with Karyakin, because again, the last match with Karyakin adopted kind of defensive posture. He was trying to win on counterattacks and almost did. Came close to winning on counterattacks. While with Caruana, we can expect more straightforward play on the part of Caruana. So I would expect more. Even I would expect more wins in this match. In that, in the Carson Karyakin, from 12 first games, actual match games, there was only one win on each side. Here, I wouldn't be surprised. It would be if the potential winner of the match would win at least two games and say lose one, and if it would be say 3-1, it also wouldn't come as a big surprise to me. So it would be, I think, a bit more resultative. Otherwise, again, I'm sure it would be a very, very exciting match. Certainly additional interest is because Caruana is an American player. So it would be certainly a very, very interesting match to watch for me, especially because I have heard about Caruana for almost, probably 12 years when he just started playing chess, because one of my students, Robert De Gregoria, was his neighbor and friend of his parents. So I heard about the Wonder Boy since he was 6 or 7. And then, of course, he was working with my friends, starting with Bruce Pendelfini, and then with Myron Cher, my good friend from Russia, and then with Alex, with Boris Zlotnik in Spain, my another good friend from Russia, then with Alex Chernin, my friend and co-author of my book on Turk. So, in other words, I heard all the time about Caruana. That's why I have kind of extra additional interest in the match. And while, again, I know Carson, he's a nice fellow and has a nice family, but both as an American and as someone who knows so much about Caruana, I would be kind of a little bit rooting for him.
Well, just hearing you talk about it gets me excited for the match. I'm also really looking forward to it, and it should be quite entertaining, and definitely does add an element of intrigue that it's a different matchup and an American player. And yeah, it is interesting how he's, we've been hearing about him forever. I also lived in New York when he was a young kid, and you know, you would hear about this young up and coming player, along with Robert Hess at the time, but it's so rare that, obviously, since only two people can play for the world championship, you hear about strong young phenoms all the time, but for them to actually ascend to the highest stage is exciting to see. So, Lev, let's bring it back a little bit to your book about the previous world championship, because I do feel like that going into detail about that also, it will continue to help set the scene. So at what point did you have the idea that you wanted to write like the definitive match book about the Carlson versus Karyakin match?
You know, when I was assured by Kirsan Ilyujinov, the president, that the match will take place in New York, and when I later learned that Karyakin would be the challenger, I immediately began to think about making the book, because I knew that in New York I will have a rare opportunity to attend games, to talk with, if not players, to talk with coaches, to talk with other grandmasters, talk to commentators like Jude Polgar. And so it would be to analyze games within process. So it would be a real first-hand experience, which would help me to make a truly great book. And my ideal was, my model was a book like Talbot Winning 1960, or speaking about candidate matches like Zurich 53, but both by David Bronstein, and also a great book on the same event by Miguel Neidorf. So I want to make a book which would be of interest for players who are themselves top players in the world who potential or few current or future world championship match players, but also the book which would be instructive and exciting for club players. And I also use it to make the book really great. And otherwise I wouldn't undertake this enterprise, because I also knew that this book is probably not the best money maker, that it would require a lot of investment, mostly of time, and the reward would be not as good as, say, a reward for writing, say, a book on Bank and Gambit or some other opening. So also greater responsibility when you write about great, real, truly great players. So to make the book really great, I knew I need a partner who himself was a world champion. And not simply a partner, but a concrete person, Vladimir Kramnik, whom I know for many years, and we are good friends for many years. And he's not only a great player, great champion, one of the most important champions, but he also is a deep thinker and very good writer on his own. So I thought that with Kramnik contributing, we really can make it a super book. So I contacted Kramnik, and he told me, you know, Lev, I'm quite busy because I'm, you know, preparing myself for various events, including Future World Championship, which I certainly wish him best of luck. But he said, if it would be something really exciting, let's see how it goes. If it's really very exciting match, then I would be glad to do it. So at some point in the match, he told me, you know, Lev, I think it's kind of something I would like to do. And at this moment, we made kind of decision to go ahead. And then I found another person who became an essential part of my team, my co-author, John Krumiller. And this is how we started working on the book.
Yeah, and it's got a format that was new to me, at least, in that, I mean, the analysis of the games is sort of the meat of the book, but you don't just present them in a typical way, in that you have what you call Vlad's take, where he interjects little insights about the openings and about the psychology of the match and about missed opportunities, and it just adds an incredible element to the book. The other thing that I really liked was the evaluation graphs, where at the conclusion of the analysis of each game, you just present a graph that shows how the computer evaluated the position through the course of the game. So it's like a visual representation of sort of the story arc of the game. So once you had the pieces in place, where you had John Krumiller collaborating with you and Vladimir Kramnik ready to add his insight, how did you decide on formatting?
We got together with John. John is my old friend. John has been my student for many years. And we started working with him when he was an expert. He soon became a master, and really a strong master, like around 2300 master. And his understanding of chess is really on grandmaster level. So John is also a great expert in computers. He is co-founder of successful computer internet of computer company, and he's really great with all kinds of computers, including chess computers. So John and I decided how we make decision in principle to start working on the book. Initially, I didn't really wanted to overwork Vladimir. Initially, I saw that Vladimir would give me a kind of brief overview of each game, and say anything he really wanted to say, but basically brief overview of each game, plus some maybe general consideration about each player, about world championships, and so on. And so we had a session after some exchanges by phone or email, we have a session by Skype. And the initial session took with John and me and Vladimir, John and I in my apartment, Vladimir in Switzerland where he lives. And the session took almost 10 hours, with maybe short breaks for 10, 15 minutes, like two or three breaks for us to get, you know, refreshed and whatever, and to have a bite. So that Vladimir contributed much more than we initially planned. because after this first session, we had additional session for several hours. And then it was done in English because Vladimir's English is quite good. But then John had to decipher. John was taking notes, but also it was all recorded. So John later had it all printed. Then we edited it. We came with questions, follow-up questions. So I took another session, as I mentioned. And when John printed like all 44 pages, single size, so it was, as I said, like maybe four times bigger than I anticipated. So it wasn't just a short review of each game. It was much, 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 much more. So it was like a treasure. And then there was a question how to use this treasure. So then we decided that the best way to do it is to incorporate it in the text in the right way. This, of course, took a lot of John's time, a lot of my time, but I think it was time well spent because, again, it was a real pleasure to work with Vladimir's work, with Vladimir's thoughts. And also, Vladimir was very, very cooperative. So whenever we had any kind of follow-up question, he was very eager to answer. In fact, he was sort of pressuring us to give him more work. He was willing, really eager to check us on each and every state. Like when we start typesetting the book, he was checking the book on typesetting per state. When the book was already done, fully done, everything was done, he double check it again, and not only his own text, but he read the entire text and gave me some suggestions. But of course, mostly, he worked on polishing his own text. He really tried to polish it very, very well. And in our case, we had very good, besides John and me, we also had very good editors and contributors like Al Lawrence, with whom I usually work on my books. Also, we had an excellent editor, Dan Lucas, who by the way is his birthday today, so I can congratulate you on his birthday. Dan Lucas is the chief editor of Chess Life, who edits my columns, so I already was used to work with him, but he certainly, here we work in a little bit different capacity, but he provided us with excellent suggestions.
Historical context in the introduction and conclusion as well.
Exactly. And so that's what we did for Vladimir. We provided him with very good text, but he still wasn't always happy. He said, look, shouldn't we use this word? Shouldn't we use better that word? So he was involved up to the very, very, very end. So this is how we worked with Vladimir. As far as John and I, again, we discussed L. And then we discussed the formats, we tried different formats. We decided to make the book really user-friendly, so we use several colors. We make it easy to open. And I also like, as you, this idea of having the graph at the end of the game. And here is the computer graph, evaluation graph. And this, by the way, is to some extent, as I mentioned before, one of the reasons I want to make this book is because I was there. And this is one of the ideas I got from watching the game, because as you may remember, during the game, they were, when I was, in this hospitality room or whatever, in whatever room I was, journalist room, they had, they showed the position, but they also showed evaluation by computer. And that evaluation wasn't really always perfect because it was kind of quick evaluation. But still, it gives some idea where the game stands. So then we decided, John and I, that if we give it at the end of the game, it will give to people some quick overview of what happened in this game. And this idea was very familiar to me. In fact, I recommended this idea of making graphs of the game. I suggested almost 30 years ago with Jeff Kastner when it was well before computers, or rather before strong computers, and you make suggestion to make evaluation of positions and then to make a graph which represent which shows very visually how the fight was fought in this game. So at this time, we, of course, with computer, we used the same evaluation which was used by computers in the tournament hall. And also, as I mentioned, John is a great expert in computers, so we were able to get most from computers. We were using different computers whenever necessary, and this is really where you have to be an expert on using those chess computers. And so what we did, whenever position was still unclear, we'll give computer more time to think, like let him think overnight. We were using different machines and comparing the analysis. In many cases, I would ask some of the great players, Kramnik, of course, but also on some occasion I asked Boris Gelfand or Boris Gulko, Sam Palatnik, Roman Dzidzichashvili, ask their opinions about certain positions. And then if necessary, we showed them to computers. So this is, in fact, in some cases, as we mentioned in the book, that is one position which computer initially gives. I think it was in the game 3, a computer was giving certain position as white is winning because white has 2 extra pawn, while in fact white is in Zugzwang. No, not really in Zugzwang, but white cannot improve his position and black can, and in fact black is winning, not white. And in several cases in game 4 where a computer kept giving white two, at least 1 point advantage, position was already a draw. So we tried to get best of computers, but we were not fully dependent on computers. We use it in I would say, in creative way, and we were not slaves to computers, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah, and you guys also build on the analysis that Anish Giri did for New in Chess. So yes. It's a nice blend of like deep engine analysis with the human super GM perspective.
Yes, exactly. We use certain Giri's analysis. We're using Judith Polgar comments, which I observed firsthand because she was doing it in the tournament hall for the visitors. We also use materials from British Chess Magazine, from Chess Life, from a new magazine called, for the exact name, I think it's called American Chess, which where Peter Tambora is one of the editors. They also had some good commentators. And of course, we also used something which was easy available for me than for John Krumiller, because I'm a Russian-speaking person. I sort of used 64 and another Russian sites and publications for comments by Russian grandmasters.
Yeah, so for any listeners who haven't checked out this book, it's a great little warm-up for the World Championship as it gets closer and closer. So, Lev, you mentioned that you've known Vlad Kramnik a long time, so just out of curiosity, do you remember first encountering him?
I remember him as a very tall boy of about 14. Tall, almost not yet 6 feet tall, but close to it at 14. And at the time, he was a student of Botvinnik school. And I remember talking to Botvinnik by phone. Botvinnik was very proud of him and predicted that he would be the next world champion. At that time, he was visiting, I think it was in one of the events which Garry Kasparov conducted when he was running a group called GMA. So it was in 1990. And Kasparov also told me that he is one of our... Kasparov at the time was also working with Botvinnik on this, school for very talented young players, where Kasparov himself was raised. Kasparov told me, he is a great player, would become soon a very strong grandmaster.
How unusual, how common was it for Botvinnik to get excited about a student and tell you about them?
Well, he was a very, usually he was a great predictor. For instance, when Kasparov was in his group, with the first soccer sparring. He was 11. Again, at the time, we already were friendly with Botvinnik. It was year 74, 75. So he immediately told me, I have a great boy from Baku. And he even showed me some of his discoveries and openings, some of his analysis. In fact, I remember Botvinnik gave him to analyze his own game with Bobby Fischer, which Botvinnik was put down and make a draw. So Kasparov found some very interesting ways make even Botvinnik's analysis kind of enlarge them and make them deeper and more precise. So Botvinnik was very proud and very impressed. So I remember he certainly predicted Kasparov to be a great player and the world champion, and he equally predicted it for Kramnik.
And I know that you've mentioned in your writing, I think it might have been in Chess Life magazine, and across your books, that you were good friends with Botvinnik and got a chance to talk to him about like how he ranked players historically and stuff. So do you have any standout stories from all the time you spent with that legendary chess player?
Botvinnik and I became very good friends, which was a little bit... a little bit unusual, our friendship, because we were of kind of very different generations. Botvinnik was born in 1911. I was born in 1945, so it was a big age difference, and also a difference in our positions. And also, he lived in Moscow, I lived in Odessa. At the time we became friends, he already was ex-world champion for almost 8 years. And I was strong master, but only a master. But somehow we got along when we had chance to meet informally. And just, he was visiting my city of Odessa, and I was one of his guides, and we kind of get along very well and like each other, so we continue to communicate by mail, by phone. So next time I went to Moscow, I came to see him, and it continued for many years before I left the Soviet Union. And Botvinnik was never my former coach, but he gave me very, very many good advices. And in fact, some people were surprised by our friendship, and there were some people, especially in the West, but even the Soviet Union, some people believed very wrongly that Botvinnik was a communist, that he was a Stalinist, and that which was certainly not true. As most Soviet people, he despised the Soviet regime, and those views we certainly shared and often discussed. But what can be a proof of my words, because of course today anyone can say anything about Botvinnik, everyone can say that he was his best friend and confidant. But when Botvinnik came to America in 1983, he was a guest of organizer of World Computer Championship, because Botvinnik was also a creator of very good, very interesting chess playing computer program. So when Botvinnik came here, he contacted me through a mutual friend. Of course, I went to see him. And I at the time was officially kind of the criminal in Soviet Union, the enemy of Soviet state, under sentence of 10 or 15 years in hard life, in jail and so on. And I was very active in anti-Soviet activities. So for Botvinnik, it was certainly really dangerous to meet me, but he not only wanted to meet me, but he tried to show it. He insisted for me to accompany him to meet, for instance, people who were doing an interview for him for Chess Life. And then when there was a photograph taken in Bad Marshall Chess Club with Botvinnik and several other grandmasters, Arthur Bisguier was there, and Semyon Reshevsky was there. Sobotynik, and we were all drinking champagne. So when photographer began to make picture, I stood aside. And Sobotynik said, "Oh, yeah, come in. I said, "Michael, this picture would be in the magazine. The magazine will go to Soviet Union. You will have problems because of me." Oh, he said, "Come on. What they can do to me, they will just let me next time to travel, you know, to travel abroad. But, you know, I'm an old man. I'm already tired of travels. It's not a big deal, okay?" And so I'm just saying that if he were really, a true communist, a true Stalinist or whatever, why he would be seeking open contacts with someone who was openly anti-communist and anti-Soviet and so on? He obviously was not. And since then, we never saw each other, unfortunately. But we communicated. I called him, he called me. I met his nephew, Igor Botvinnik, who was his assistant in his last years of life and continued his life in Divas with chess, in computer chess. So Igor Botvinnik was on several occasions in New York. We also became good friends, and I helped him with various projects which he was taking on behalf of his uncle. So again, Botvinnik, I learned a lot from him. And it's not all that I learned a lot from him. He was a very pleasant person to deal with. And I didn't simply enjoy being his friend. And I just learned from him many things, not only about chess per se, chess moves, but also how to approach chess. And his characteristic of various players were very interesting, including characteristic of, of personalities like Lasker, Capablanca, and, you know, others. So also, just to make one quick observation, I knew personal world champions, starting with Max Oive, who was world champion number 5. I knew all new champions like Carlsen. I knew, of course, I played with Anand, but Anand was only 17. It was in 1988. So I knew really all world champions. With many of them I played, analyzed, played. And my overall impression is that not only they all were certainly great players, but mostly they were also very most interesting and also generally good people. I can name only 2 persons whom I wouldn't consider a good person, but still those were great players. So even though I don't consider them good people, good persons, I still enjoy their games and their analysis.
Well, you can name them, but I can name them.
It's not a surprise. One of them is our old countryman Bobby Fischer, with whom I was.
Yeah, I would have guessed that.
With whom I was in touch, and he's sort of an interesting personality. I arranged for some of my students to meet him. I did it through Boris Spassky, who was remaining Bobby Fischer very close friend till Dave Fischer died. But why I consider him not a good person? It's not really because of, you know, even of his anti-American or anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish statements, because he was crazy at the time. But if you look at his life, when he even before he became a kind of nutcase, when he was still more or less normal mentally, he wasn't a nice person, to say the least. Like how he treated his own coach, Collins, who gave him a lot. And when Fischer became world champion, Collins got an offer from, I guess, big publisher to write a book on chess, how to teach chess. And they expected that Fischer would write an introduction or at least give a blurb. And Fischer categorically said no. And in fact, gave kind of, to the press, quite negative comments about the book, about Collins himself, or why you care about him, who is this Collins, you know, who knows nothing about chess, come on, you should write about me, you know, something like that. And this remained with him through his whole life, on life, but you probably read the story that when he was arrested in Japan, the Icelandic policeman who was his guard in 1972 when he played Major Spassky in Iceland, the Icelandic policeman at the time retired, my name's Sammy, whom I met when I played myself chess in Iceland in mid-80s. A very nice man, very kind of plain man, not rich man, not a politician. A policeman, a retired policeman. He decided to help Bobby. He started a big campaign in Iceland, which eventually ended by Icelandic parliament giving Fisher the citizenship of Iceland. And therefore, Japanese released Fisher into Icelandic custody. So rather being extradited to the United States, which where he could be extradited and he was punished for some tax violation or whatever, he was, allowed to go to Iceland, where he was received as a great hero and so on. And of course, there was movies about Fisher made in Iceland. But then one Icelandic company decided to make a movie about this fellow, a semi-policeman, just, to show a normal, a simple man. And this was a movie about Semi. And not about Fisher, who already has his share of movies. To make movie about Semi, and Fisher was simply asked to appear in this movie very briefly. And Fisher didn't like it, and he didn't like the Semi as hero of the movie, and he didn't like that Semi was paid something, not much, for playing himself in the movie. So he basically, he declined to play any part, do anything with this movie, but he even threatened to sue them because, they're making money on his own story. So close to the core story with the Collins that it was, something wrong with the guy. As his lawyer, whose name was Marshall, who collected for him many endorsements, which Bobby first accepted and then disappeared. It was soon after he won the match. Marshall told me, I think he was right, that Bobby simply couldn't stand the idea of someone making even a penny on him. In other words, in my case, for instance, someone brings me, for instance, a chess student, And he's saying, look, by the way, I have a chess student for you, but I also want, you can show him something, let's say Bianca Gambit, and I then work with him on Sicilian, which I am an expert. Would you mind to do it? And I said, fine. Well, put differently, if someone help you with something, I don't mind paying my share, be it a bit of royalty, a tip, a gift, whatever. It seems normal. I would love to share with someone who helped me. But in the case of Fisher, and this was testified by all his friends and acquaintances, he really couldn't stand that someone would make even a little bit on him. And so this is certainly, again, it doesn't change my opinion of Fisher as being a very great chess player, and I enjoy his games, and he was an interesting person in many aspects. He wasn't a great thinker, as he probably thought he was, but he was an interesting person. Even he was semi-educated, but some of his thoughts were interesting, but he certainly wasn't a good person. And another person whom I don't like as a person was Ali Hine. Another great player, of course, not as great as Capablanca, but still great. But he was also kind of a bad person, in a little bit different way than Bobby. He certainly was a very educated person, but he had kind of tendency. He wanted to be loved by authorities. So he was trying to, to do more than what he had to do, like when he played in, when he was in Soviet Union, and he was a nobleman by birth, he went to work for Bolsheviks, and we didn't help him. He was almost killed. Then when he left Soviet Union, escaped from Soviet Union, he became a strong, open anti-Bolshevik, and then again he began pro-Bolshevik when he decided it would be good for him one day to come to play in Soviet Union. When there was Olympiad, the last Olympiad, I think it was in Buenos Aires, before the World War II, when the war started, Alekhine demonstratively prohibited his team, French team, to play against the German team, which was really crazy. And German team was not really mostly Germans. Many of them were in fact Jews, and many of them stayed in Argentina for political asylum. So when Alekhine came back to France, he volunteered for service, in the army service, even he was not young, he was quite old, and certainly not fit to serve, but he made a gesture. And then when France lost the war, he was at the time out France, outside France, but he went back to France, and he became very eager pro-Nazi, he wrote those anti-Semitic articles, which really no one wanted him to write, because for Germans, Russian Alekhine was really a great example of a perfect Aryan man. They really want him, were happy to have him in Europe, to play chess, to give samples in hospitals, and so on. But he wanted to prove that he wanted to be more royal than the king, more Catholic than the Pope. And this really made him, from what I heard from people who knew him personally, like Botvinnik, not a very pleasant man. But he certainly was a great player. No doubt about it. But again, my overall point is that if you look at chess players who were champions, Steinitz, Lasker, Fablanka, if you look at all this group, Kasparov, Karpov, Kramnik, of course, Stahl, generally speaking, those were normal people and mostly good people. And also some of them were remarkable people even outside of chess, like Kramnik, for instance, Botvinnik definitely, Capablanca definitely, Lasker, Steinitz.
Yeah. Yeah, I recently had I.M. Saravanan from India on, and he's old friends with Anand, and he was telling stories about Anand's vast knowledge of the world beyond chess. So I think
I don't know Anand so well personally, even if you play with him and spend some time when you first time met at the interzonal tournament, but I know a lot about him from my friends who were his coaches, including Mark Dvoretsky, and they all told me that he's sort of very, very interesting person. A very good person also outside chess.
Well, those were some amazing stories, Lev. I could listen to you tell stories for hours, but we have so many topics to discuss. I also want to talk about your other books. I mean, you're such a prolific author. You really, around the time you retired from active competing in chess, you really stepped up your output, and you've got the comprehensive chess course of many volume course sort of taking you from beginner to intermediate to advanced level, and you've got the very popular pocket books that you wrote, one on your own and one with Al Lawrence. Which book are you most proud that you've written?
Well, again, I'm really seriously speaking, I'm most proud of making the course. I think there are books by other authors, and I would be glad to mention some of them. I already mentioned Talbot Finnick, Zurich 53. There are some books which I think are better than even my best books. But what I think I did almost probably the best, and probably certainly the first, is to make a course. When I begin to write this and publish this comprehensive chess course, there were very really no courses. I wanted to make a course from beginner to master based on the same system of chess education which was used for years in Soviet Union, and of the system I was myself a product. So I wrote, or as I published, first two volumes, which were written by my own old coach from Odessa, Russia, Roman Peltz, who now lives in Canada. Then I continued the score with Sam Palatnik. Then I wrote, or rather co-wrote, a book on endgame with Nikolai Krodius, another famous Russian grandmaster who wished to Boris Spassky. And this book also got Book of the Year award called Just Effects. I wrote then opening books with Roman Dzhenchenkovsky and Eugen Perlenstein. So after that, some other authors did their courses, like Yasser Seravan wrote quite a good course. But I think my course was both first and really most comprehensive. It's bigger and it covers greater territory. And so I'm very proud, first of all, of the overall course. If to speak about individual books, certainly the book on Endgame is a great book. It was certainly correctly rewarded the CGA Book of the Year award. I was even especially pleased when I talked with Hannon Russell, my friend and big publisher, who told me that my book on Endgame with Krodius was the best book on Endgames ever. And it was even bigger compliment because Hannon himself published a truly great book by Mark Dvoretsky, Endgame, Dvoretsky's Endgame course. And Hannon told me, yes, Mark's book is great, but Mark's book is for players at least starting at 2100 level. And your book is starting, say, on 1600 level and going up. So I certainly like very much this Roman Peltz's books, Volume 1, Volume 2. I really like them all. As far as my pocketbooks, they are also very proud of them, and they were a result of my own experience of as a chess teacher. When I was playing chess, and especially when I stopped playing chess professionally in the early 90s, I was giving many chess lessons. In those days, I often give lessons also by telephone. And to do those lessons effectively, I have several programs which consisted in many positions which I selected myself or borrowed or exchanged with my fellow coaches like, say, Mark Dvoretsky or Dzhenchenkovsky or Palatnik and or Peltz. And I was giving those positions, be it by phone or in person, to my students. And I had again like several thousand of those positions. So I was able to observe which positions have which effect on people, which positions work only with certain categories of students, and which positions has had greater appeal. So then I was thinking, okay, maybe I can make a book of those positions like one size fits all. Of course, individually made suit is better. But, you know, if you're good in your profession, you can make also a good suit, one size fit all or something like that. So I decided to make a book of those positions. And my idea was that to be, say, a master, you don't need to know too much, but you need to know something. And they said, make a kind of assumption that you need to know about 300 positions. Of course, the number is not firm. It can be 400, it can be 250. And also what to call a position. You often can take one position, divide it into three, or you can combine two or three positions in one team. But basically, it gives you the idea of what I was looking for. So I made this book, 300 most important positions. I really try to select positions which are really, truly most important. So if someone knows them by heart, he probably knows almost everything he needs to know, maybe besides opening, to become a master. And let's say a smaller number of positions, say 150, 200, would make the same for the expert. And they also try to make this not only a collection of positions, but also a training book, because in chess we need training. We need, we, and we we can and we should train our chest capability the same way as an athlete trains his muscle with different devices. So I make this, I make my exercise book with emphasis on practicality, because many books have, and I don't say that the books are wrong, but I think it's my approach is slightly different. Most books on puzzles or tests, they would either divide position by subjects, which is already a hint, which we don't have in the game, or they would decide, at the very end, they would decide by level. It's very complex, it's not so complex. But when you play a game, no one tells you if position is complex or not. No one tells you it's even if it's something, it's a knight sacrifice or pawn sacrifice. I even intentionally added some positions where I kind of counterintuitive, because when you have a book, or when someone asks you to solve a position, you assume it should be something beautiful there, because if not, why you ask to solve this position? But in real life, as you know, as a chess player, in most positions, a beautiful move is not always the best move. Very often, a normal move, a mundane move is the best move. Sometimes you have several moves which are good, equally good. So what I did, I put in these books, my first book, 300 Most Important Positions, I put a couple, probably more than a couple, probably like five or six positions, where the right move is not a tempting combination, where the tempting combination is in fact either wrong, can be refused, or at least second best, and the right move is really almost all of the above. You can look, you can play, you can castle, you can play h3, you can play a3. In other words, you have several normal-looking moves, which are good, which are equally good, so whatever you choose. I may have some preference, like I mentioned. I would here play this way, but all other moves are practically equally good, except for the sacrifice which can be refused. And I also try to make hints, like, if you cannot solve it, look at the name of the team. So the name of the position, I give them, or as I learned, give them various names, like sometimes direct, like knight sacrifice, sometimes more sophisticated. So people can, if you cannot solve it, say in a couple of minutes, you learn, you look at on title. If you cannot learn, solve it another 5 minutes, you look at subtitle, and it will give you, it give you a hint that helps you set to solve it. I also, using advice of my friends, my like Mark Dvoretsky, really great chess coach, whom I often invited to the United States to work with my students, I also explain in the introduction how you can use several positions to make an exercise. Like, because in real game, when it's often a trade-off between how much time you spend on each move and what is the quality of your moves. So I would give, let's say, four positions which are on the same spread, and the person would know that he has, say, 20 positions, 20 minutes to solve four positions. You solve it correctly, fine, you go ahead for the next position. You solve it incorrectly, you have some time deducted from you, and it depends how incorrectly you went. You know, if you, instead of winning, make a losing move, say, deducted 8 minutes. If instead of winning, you make a drawish move, deducted 4 minutes. If you make, as I mentioned in the previous example, you make a reasonable move, but not the best move, maybe you invited, deducted 1 minute, something like that. So again, I like this book also very much. And usually, and of course, I like very much the book on the match, because again, among other things, it gave me a chance to work together with John and computers, where John is great, and of course to work with great Vladimir Kramnik.
Okay, yeah, and I've been using the chess training book. I mean, I enjoy the puzzles in it, but also it's a handy thing for a chess teacher to have, because if you ever just need a one-off puzzle, The size makes it easy to carry around, and you can just pick one out, and it's generally there's going to be an instructive theme on it. And you just answered, we had a question from a supporter of the podcast, Zhivko Stoyanov, and you just answered the first half of the question as it happens, but the second half of the question relating to your chess training pocketbook is, how did you decide on the design and content of the front cover of the first
days? I was already working with L. Lawrence, who before working with me was executive director of Chess Federation and certainly great expert on advertising. Later, L was working as director of Hall of Fame in Florida. So L was advising me on the cover. And so we decided to use a model, not really a model, simply it was a Russian girlfriend of mine. And so we decided to make a picture of us together analyzing chess positions. I think it's quite a reasonable decision because the first thing for someone who wants to buy a book, say in a bookstore, you have to take the book in your hands. And if you see something attractive, like a beautiful woman, you probably would be the first book you take into your hand, in your hands. In chess, the vast majority of people playing chess are men. So it was a natural decision to put a beautiful woman on a cover. I was there, but I don't think I was really very needed there. Certainly not to appeal to women chess players, but I was needed there because I was, after all, an author and also kind of familiar face for chess live readers. So I wouldn't say that it's something I would do with all of my books. On some books, I have human faces. On my first book, by Roman Peltz, Comprehensive Chess Course, Volume 1, book for very beginners, I have also a beautiful Russian woman, Anna Malova, who was earlier the runner-up in Russian beauty contest, I guess, 1990. And the daughter of the photographer is as if the mother teaches your daughter. And on the second volume, I was the one teaching photographer's son. So it's how we make our first volumes. But most recently, most of my recent books don't contain any personalities. So it's not really something I do always. I think it was L idea, L Lawrence idea, and I think it was a good idea.
Yeah, and that was one of your more successful books, right?
Yes, it was certainly one of the. As usual, more successful books were my opening books, which is natural. Opening books are usually more successful. But this book and this 300 most important position was very successful, probably sold like 15,000 or something, maybe more. And the follow-up, 320 position, was also quite successful, maybe selling like 12,000 or 10,000, something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting to get the actual numbers of what like a popular chess book sells. And I recently had Andy Soltis on, and he was discussing the most popular chess books of all time, which I think he mentioned Chess for Dummies by James Eade. And do you have a sense for what those sell? I mean, I know Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess is like legendarily rumored to have sold like seven figures of copies. Do you have any sense of what the numbers are like on the best-selling chess books?
You know, I also heard very high numbers for those books like Chess for Dummies, or there is some other series, Chess for Ages or something like that.
Idiots, yes,
Patrick Wolf. I think Chess for Dummies, I guess I even discussed the numbers with Peter Kurzdorfer was, oh no, Jim Mead was the author, yes. I talk about with Jim Mead. I think this book was sold maybe close to 100,000 copies, which is excellent, which is enormously good for chess, for the chess book. I think that this was partly because the book is really excellent, but also partly because it was part of the series. And was usually, from my experience and from experience of my colleagues, both chess writers and chess publishers, usually a chess publisher would publish 3,000 copies for the book. This is considered to be a reasonable number. Some modest publishers would publish 2,000. When my books were published by other quite established publishers, like Batford, for instance, I wrote a book for Batford on Alekhine defense. I think they published 3 or 4, maximum 5,000 copies. I usually published at least 5,000 copies, my first print. I often publish 7,000 copies first print. I'm kind of optimistic about my books. Usually, of course, the books which sell the best would be opening books, like when I publish a book with Alex Chernin on Perk Alert, I publish 5,000 copies, and in less than 4 months, they all have been sold. So in 3 months, I begin to work on reprint with correction. In case of Ginger's book on openings, I published 7,000 copies, and in less than a year, both were sold, and they published very quickly a reprint of 5,000. So opening books are doing very, very well, especially, of course, in the first several years. Then they would kind of plateau, which is natural. While other books, like Comprehensive Chess Course Volume 1, Volume 2, Books for Beginners, or another excellent book, really one of my favorites, maybe because it was most difficult to produce, the book Chess for the Gifted and Busy, which is really a condensation of all my previous books into one volume. Because I came to conclusion, working with my students mostly, that for most of chess players, really most chess players don't have time to work on chess as slowly, as meticulously as often was done in Russian chess, where chess was part of curriculum in many schools and so on. So like in my book with Roman Peltz, in first volume, I guess we introduce the castle in level on lesson 6, which is certainly not something we'll do in America. People would not wait for six lessons to learn the rule of castle. So I decided I should squeeze those things, books, tactics, strategy, assuming that my student reader is very gifted. I'm sure that some of readers are gifted. So that's why we created this book, Chess for the Gifted and Busy. And this is also a book which sells very, very well. And we sold first edition quite quickly, first 7,000, and we sold 5,000 reprint. And now we have second edition, which we also make a reprint of second edition. Usually good books on important subjects are selling very, very well. Books which are not so direct, like books of the stories and so on, they sell, but they don't sell that well. But still, I like my books on all subjects. I wrote a book, for instance, of stories and photographs called 3 Days with Bobby Fischer. There I really give stories about Fischer, which I knew firsthand, which I helped arrange myself, meeting with him, but also give other stories and games and some thoughts about chess. It was more like potpourri. And also, for instance, Ellen and I also make a book, Chess Rules of Thumb, which is mostly for entertaining. Such books do sell, but they don't sell that well. So let's say we publish 7,000 Chess Rules of Thumb, and I still have maybe like 3,000 left after 14 years. But it sells. It sells, but kind of sells slowly. But generally speaking, I like my books. It also works for me quite well with my teaching chess, because when I write books, I have in mind my students. And when I work with students, I often get ideas which I can use in books. So those two things work like hand and glove.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just a couple more questions on books. So do you have anything happening now? Are you working on anything currently?
Not really. At the moment, I mostly work on mostly reprinting some old books. But when I do reprint, I always introduce corrections. We also L. Lawrence and I are thinking about making a third edition, revised edition of Chess for the Gifted and Busy. I don't have any truly big projects. I mostly teach. I keep on my books, and whenever necessary, I do some correction, improvement here and there. Otherwise, I don't have any kind of big projects. I work, for instance, with Max Blugi and Anatoly Karpov, and Karpov was here for second year in a row, having this summer camp together at Max's place in Manhattan, so which sort of was enjoyable to work again with such a great player.
Yeah, amazing that students get the opportunity to learn from players of that stature.
Yes, I think it was certainly a good service for them. You're right.
Okay, and one more on chess books, Lev. So you mentioned our listeners always like recommendations, and you already mentioned the Tal Botvinnik match book as well as the two books about Zurich 1953. Do you have any other favorite chess books by authors other than yourself?
Of course. I would suggest I like books by Bruce Pendelfini. He has many books written. Most of them, if not all, are very good. Some of them are great. My favorite is the book called Chess Doctor, but it's really my taste. It's really an excellent book. Also, for those who want to learn endgame quickly, but not very deeply, but quickly and well, or those who want to have kind of a book which helps them to review their knowledge of endgame, I would certainly suggest Pendelfini's Endgame course. It's easy to use, very good selection of positions. Those two books. Yasser has many good books. Yasser Saravan, Susan Polgar wrote many good books, both for beginners and also for more advanced players. Mark Dvoretsky wrote many good books, many great books, really. But those,
yeah,
especially
sure
his Dvoretsky's Endgame course, those go more for stronger players, for experts and masters, at the very least. As we already discussed, Bronstein's Zurich 53 and Nider of Zurich 53 are among two greatest tournament books. Of course, almost everything that's written by Capablanca is great. And it's not just because for my reverence for him and his name, but it's really great. I myself often use material from his books with my students or give them to read his books, Chess Fundamentals, for instance, Basics of Chess and so on. Also, there are books, special books, which if you want to improve something in your chess, you can use books. Let's say, like on Rubinstein and games. There are some books by, besides some classical books, which mostly we discussed so far, there are also books on more contemporary players and writers. Gary Kasparov's books, My Great Predecessors, are excellent books, and especially like his first two volumes. I'm sure the other ones are also good, but I think first two volumes are really great and can be helpful not only for master and grandmaster, but also can be useful and enjoyable by a club player. Also, books by Boris Gelfand, they're advanced, serious, but for serious players, books by Gelfand would be excellent reading. And I'm sure I'm leaving Sunil Ramantri wrote several good books. Andy Soltis wrote some excellent books. It's always entertaining, but also some of them also very, very instructive. So also to give an advice, I think that one of the best things you can do, especially if someone lives in New York, it is not a promotion for a friend, but simply good advice for your listener, for your listeners. You need to look at the, it's good to look at the book before you're buying it in most cases. So if you have a choice, go to normal bookstore like Barnes & Noble. You'll see big book, chess book selection. So browse for them and then decide which couple of books you would like to take. Also, New York, if you're in New York City, downtown New York City, there is a bookstore by Fred Wilson. So you can drop by.
Yes, recent guest, of course.
I forgot. So you can tell more about Fred than I can. So you can tell about Fred. Why I mentioned Fred? Because I often refer to him, my students, because, of course, you can go to Barnes & Noble, find often same books, but the seller in the Barnes & Noble, the clerk wouldn't explain you how to use chess books. While Fred,
right,
especially with introduction by me, what my student needs would often always find something good for this particular person.
Excellent. Yeah, and Lev, so you've had many sort of successful, like there was a Bloomberg profile of you where they talk about how you've worked with a lot of sort of successful finance people from the finance industry and taught them chess, and a lot of sort of higher profile and more successful adult students. Do you have any advice that you find yourself giving to people regarding chess improvement over and over again? Like, what's your overall philosophy for the enthusiastic chess hobbyist?
Okay, to try again to make advice like one size fits all, in other words, not detail. Of course, obviously, to give good advice, you need to know the person, and advice certainly varies from person to person. But advice, chessic advice, well, for someone who is not a professional player, doesn't want to be a professional player, but want to play somewhat better chess, okay, my first advice would be, if you like to play chess, play chess. If you cannot ideally combine various types of chess, play on the internet, but also play in clubs. If you have no time to play in clubs, play on the internet. But even in this case, try to vary. Don't play all blitz games. Play some blitz game. It's fine. But say you spend 5 hours playing blitz or playing, say, 15 minutes per game chess. But maybe put another 5 hours a month and play one long time control game, or at least play a couple of 1 hour per game games on the internet. Also, very importantly, analyze your games. If you play a game and didn't analyze them, you're getting some benefits, but your benefits are maybe like 20-30%, and the rest is wasted. So my advice would be definitely analyze your games, especially those which you played in a little bit longer time control. When you play on the internet, many of my students, not complain, but telling me, well, don't pay attention to my mistake here. I was interrupted by somebody, my nephew, by my niece, by my son, or by my partner, which is understandable. You know, you enjoy chess and you play it at home, so when you can be interrupted by your favorite pet or your member of the family, it's fine. But if you want to be really to judge yourself as a player, to learn more about yourself as a player, try to set aside some time where you're not interrupted. Maybe do it once a week. Set aside an hour or two where you say everyone is asleep. You don't expect any important calls. So you can play, say, a serious game, say, 1 hour per game on the internet or with a friend. And then such a game, analyze carefully. Spend at least half an hour, ideally 1 hour analyzing the game. after you analyze the game, not before, but after, check your analysis with computer. Computer would not tell you why one move is better than another, but computer would, and you don't need computer for this. And you don't really, shouldn't really care much when computer says that why was better by, was it say why was better by quarter of a pawn, now why is better by one-tenth of the pawn. It's really not that correct, always not really that important, unless it's explained why. But what computer will do to you, for you, is if on one move you would see that the value of white position jumped up 3 points, so now you white is up 4 points, and then the next move is back down only 1 point, well, it means that you had a chance to win a piece and you missed it. And so you would look at position more carefully, or you would look at computer suggestion what is best move, and you would say, oh, here I will look a chance, both me and my opponent will look a chance, you know, for me to win a piece, for him to save a piece, and so on. So use computer only as a second, you know, as a follow-up for your analysis. And if you have a coach, of course, show it to the coach after you show it to your computer. Also, read chess books, and I certainly would recommend this book for Gifted and Busy, but I also would recommend other books. In fact, any book you like, any book which appeals to you. And usually I think it's good to have two books on the same subject, to have one book as your kind of main book. So you learn, for instance, from that book, you learn, say, how to, say, sacrifice, bishop take h7 sacrifice. You learn from, say, my book, for instance, from Palatnik book, Chess Tactics. And then you take Servan's book on tactics and look at the same subject from his book, which is certainly after you already did my book, you would be much better prepared and you would do better. But it also would give you a little bit different angle how to look at the same and the same and the same position, the same ideas, and so on. So again, play chess, analyze your games, read good books, which you not only need but which you enjoy. So if you have some books which you read because you need them, like say you play certain openings, so you need a book on this opening, so you study this book, fine. Or you study a book on endgames, on strategy, which is good. But in addition to books which are good and important, try to have at least one book which you really enjoy. It can be, say, among such books, I would, for instance, mention a book by Michael Tal, which is called Life and Games of Michael Tal, by Michael Tal himself. Why I like this book? Tal was certainly a great player. He was also an excellent, entertaining writer. And it's certainly a very enjoyable book for many to read. So you probably would benefit from it both benefit and enjoy it. But again, maybe someone else would enjoy more some another book. So again, that's why my advice, go to the store, or go to Fred, go to the store, browse through the books, try to find at least one book which you simply would enjoy, which you would simply enjoy reading. Also, it's always good to have a friend with whom you can play, with whom you can analyze. It is true for great players. It helps to become a great player if you have a partner, a friend. It's also enjoyable if you simply do it. You're simply doing it for fun.
Okay, that is excellent advice. And Lev, I just have, just one more question from you. It's from a supporter of the podcast, Tyron Ross, who vis-a-vis competing asks, how has age affected you? Do you have tips for aspiring aging guys like me to try to maintain the brain power? I'm almost 60 and getting back into some over-the-board and online competition.
Okay. No, I don't have any concrete advice. I know that my friend, very famous American grandmaster, Arnold Denker, who was not only very great, very an excellent grandmaster, but also quite successful businessman and very pleasant person. And Arnold makes some kind of research, and he found out that people who play chess being great players, but also club players. They usually develop various age ailment, mental ailment on much, much lesser levels than people who don't play chess. And like Alzheimer and other diseases of the mind. And he explained it, and his friend's doctor explained it by saying that when you do something mentally challenging like chess, this helps, you know, it exercise your brain and help it to stay, to remain healthy and effective and so on. I did that, thank God I didn't feel and don't feel any kind of age effects on me, except that, you know, I walk a little more slowly and I gain a little bit weight because they have nice restaurants in my area and probably not enough willpower to resist always. But as far as my mental state, I cannot complain. It didn't affect my writing. It didn't affect my, I think so, it didn't affect my teaching. It didn't really so much affect my playing. I play occasionally. I sort of often play with my students. Some of them are experts and masters. And I play them with them usually challenging game. I play position where I say I'm worse, giving them various chances to beat me. So I have to fight them back to compete. I often give myself little time. No longer 1 minute per game, but I certainly can play 3 minutes per game. I do it quite well. I played relatively recently, a couple of years ago, my friend Anatoly Machulsky was, and our mutual friend Sam Palatnik have been sponsoring and organizing tournaments, so-called Friends Veteran Tournament, not really veteran tournament, of friends of Machulsky and Palatnik. And I play in those tournaments. I played sometimes with my age peers, and it was interesting games. I also played one of those tournaments. I played with very strong and ambitious young women player like Irina Krush, Alexandra Kostyniuk. I lost to Irina Krush, but I defeated, and I think it's very good, really beautiful game. I defeated Alexandra Kostyniuk, who is strong among a men player, and it was a good game, and Alexandra was former world champion. So it's, in other words, I would say that I certainly don't play as well as I played 30 years ago when I was 1990 when I became for the last time U.S. Invitational Champion. But I wouldn't even put mostly it's for the ages, mostly because rather than studying myself, my own chess, my own opening, I'm now working mostly on what is important for my students. My own strength is certainly less than used to be, but it's not catastrophically less. And I'm sure if, for instance, when I decide to play in those tournaments to begin to prepare, I remember I very quickly recovered most, at least 50%, probably more of my old strength, so to speak. So one thing which certainly can be said, that certainly playing chess should be helpful to someone's brain. It's very likely other mental activities like Sudoku or whatever also helpful, but we certainly cannot speak about them. I can speak about chess. Based on my experience with my students, some of them, I used to have students who were over 90 years old and quite bright and sharp, and not only in chess. I think that chess can be helpful, and chess also can be enjoyable, and it's really best combination when you have both, something which is helpful but also enjoyable.
Okay, yeah, excellent advice. So mainly, Tyron, just stick with it.
Exactly.
Okay. Excellent. Well, this has been a real pleasure, Lev. And for any listeners who want more from Lev, obviously you can read his books. There's also an excellent interview in American Chess Magazine that you mentioned with Pete Tamboro, where apparently you guys spent 8 or 9 hours together. So just incredible detail in that as well. So thank you so much for your time. If If listeners want to reach you, do you make your information available, or would you prefer to stay off the grid?
No, as it were? I'm a public person advertising Chess Live. My telephone is in yellow pages. It's 212-794-8706. You also can give people my email, which is easy to remember. It's GM for Grandmaster, GM Lev Albert at AOL.com, so people can email me. And if you have any questions about something, be it chess, books, lessons, or maybe I often receive, for instance, comments in writing or by email, comments regarding my books. And if the comment is correct, I would always use it in my new edition or new reprint of the book. So those comments are quite welcome. Otherwise, one small request to you. I don't know if it would be easy for you to do, but if you would have, if you will have this printed, I certainly would be glad to read it for myself. And if you will have some feedback from your listeners, I certainly always would be glad to listen, to read the feedback, and if would be something of real interest for you and your and the audience, I would be glad to answer on those for you.
Okay, excellent. I will definitely pass along any feedback, and as for the transcripts, it is on my to-do list, but my to-do list is kind of long.
It's no rush.
Okay.
Very good, so be well.
Excellent.
And again, hope to see you soon at some of Chess events in New York.
Okay, thank you so much, Lev. It's
pleasure,
been an honor and a pleasure. Stay in touch.
See you soon.
Okay, take care. Thanks to friend of the podcast, Geert Vandervelt, for supplying the intro music. Thanks to my producer, Matthew Passy, as always. And thanks to everyone who supports the show by telling a friend or writing a positive review on your podcast platform. But most of all, I want to give thanks to those of you who've given financial support to the show. Without you guys, Perpetual Chess would not be possible. I also want to give special thanks to my Patreon and PayPal Perpetual partners. This list continues to grow, which is a wonderful thing. It keeps the podcast healthy, keeps the episodes coming, and lets me dream up plans to improve the podcast over time. So special thanks go out to Adam Ralph, Adam Vrancouge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Ali Morchetti, Andre Krizdwa, Brian Mullis, Carl Labons, I am Carlos Perdomo, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Chris Chabris, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Selicki, Coach J's Chess Academy, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, Daniel Vinay, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Elect, Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortoris, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, I am Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Yaka Bagard of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jennifer Valens, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Hartman, John Jernigan, WGM Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Johnny McMenamin, WGM Katerina Nemkova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopalakrishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Lek Ambrzkowski, I hope I did okay there, Lek, Leo Delgado, Lorraine Dore, Matthew Passy, Macaulay Peterson, Matthew Tedesco, Nate Salon, Nathan Webster, Pascal Charbonneau, Paul Sweeney, Paolo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek, Robert Steiner, Ryan Stone, Steiner Lima, Tatyav Abrahamian, Thomas Stonix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancouge, Zhao Chang, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks a lot, guys. Catch y'all next week.
Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.